the same way people got enraged when they saw kids being led away in chains when they went into the South with William Seward or John Brown, when they saw people being beaten or pulled away in chains. I can't go by the courthouses that often anymore because I can't stand seeing a couple of 10, 15 black and Latino kids being led in by white guys like a chain gang in there by the Warren Squad. These guys are, you know, for stupid things like jaywalking. They didn't pay their jaywalking fare. They didn't pay for trespassing, open container, and these guys come in. It's a very depressing thing to see, and I'm tired of seeing it. I'm 60 years old. You know, you just get fed up after a while seeing these people being paraded around.
All right. We have been speaking with Randy Credico. Randy, we want to keep very close track because you are facing very serious charges for having the courage, more courage than I have ever seen in terms of standing up to police violence in motion happening in front of you. It's a pretty courageous thing you do, and we're going to watch it very closely. Thanks for being with us, Randy. Be careful.
28.
KBOO Community Radio is looking for qualified candidates to fill two vacant board seats. The KBOO Board of Directors invites qualified KBOO members who are interested in becoming a board member to submit a candidate statement no longer than 500 words, which should include the applicant's experience, information about previous board or coalition experience, and why they want to serve on the KBOO Board of Directors. Please email your candidate statement to Timothy Welp at kboocommunity@gmail.com by March 13th, 2015. Candidates should also plan on being present at the March 23rd, 6 p.m. KBOO Board of Directors meeting to present a short statement about why they are interested in joining KBOO Board of Directors. Again, KBOO is looking for qualified candidates to serve on the Board of Directors. Application due March 13th and public presentations will be made March 23rd. More information can be found at kboo.fm/boardvacancies2015.
I'm out to sing songs that'll prove to you that this is your world, and that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that'll make you take pride in yourself.
I'm Lori Sonnenfeld.
And I'm Don Jacobson.
Together we bring you Moving On, Fridays from 12 noon to 1:30.
We feature both traditional and contemporary folk music.
We love to present live in-studio concerts from local and national musicians.
Tune in and you'll hear music that is socially progressive, moving, and heartfelt.
Music heard only on the left-hand edge of the dial and only on KBOO.
Every Friday, noon to 1:30.
We who believe in freedom cannot.
This is.
I'm out to sing songs.
Yes, we know that. And this is KBOO Portland, your community radio. Coming up next on the. At 11. It's actually 11:02 right now. Coming up on the Digital Divide, we had the actual founder of the internet speaking with one of the internet's greatest heroes, Edward Snowden, at a TED Talk in 2014. Mr. Snowden joined the group via Skype, and we've got this audio for you. And followed by a segment from Democracy Now! About how the government spies on your cell phone use. So give a listen right now.
location somewhere in Russia, controlling the spot with from his laptop. So he can see what the bot can see. Ed, welcome to the TED stage. What can you see, as a matter of fact?
I can see everyone. This is amazing.
Ed, some questions for you. You've been called many things in the last few months. You've been called a whistleblower, a traitor, a hero. What words would you describe yourself with?
You know, everybody who's involved with this debate has been struggling over me and my personality and what, how to describe me. But when I think about it, this isn't the question that we should be struggling with. Who I am really doesn't matter at all. If I'm the worst person in the world, you can hate me and move on. What really matters here are the issues. What really matters here is the kind of government we want, the kind of internet we want, the kind of relationship between people and societies. And that's what I'm hoping the debate will move towards, and we've seen that increasing over time. If I had to describe myself, I wouldn't use words like hero, I wouldn't use patriot, and I wouldn't use traitor. I'd say I'm an American and I'm a citizen, just like everyone else.
Hmm. So just to give some context for those who don't know the whole story. This time, a year ago, you were stationed in Hawaii working as a consultant to the NSA. You had, as a sysadmin, you had access to their systems. And you began revealing certain classified documents to some hand-picked journalists, leading the way to June's revelations. Now, what propelled you to do this?
You know, when I was sitting in Hawaii, and the years before when I was working in the intelligence community, I saw a lot of things that had disturbed me. We do a lot of good things in the intelligence community, things that need to be done and things that help everyone. But there are also things that go too far. There are things that shouldn't be done and decisions that were being made in secret without the public's awareness, without the public's consent, and without even our representatives in government having knowledge of these programs. When I really came to struggle with these issues, I thought to myself, how can I do this in the most responsible way that maximizes the public benefit while minimizing the risks? And out of all the solutions that I could come with, out of going to Congress when there was no laws, there were no legal protections for a private employee, a contractor in intelligence like myself, there was a risk that I would be buried along with the information and the public would never find out. But the First Amendment of the United States Constitution guarantees us a free press for a reason. And that's to enable an adversarial press to challenge the government, but also to work together with the government, to have a dialogue and debate about how we can inform the public about matters of vital importance without putting our national security at risk. And by working with journalists, by giving all of my information back to the American people, rather than trusting myself to make the decisions about publication, we've had a robust debate with a deep investment by the government that I think has resulted in a benefit for everyone. And the risks that have been threatened, the risks that have been played up by the government have never materialized. We've never seen any evidence of even a single instance of specific harm.
So let's
of that, I'm comfortable with the decisions that I make.
So let me show the audience a couple of examples of what you revealed. If we can have a slide up. And Ed, I don't know whether you can see, the slides are here. This is a slide of the PRISM program. And maybe you could tell the audience what that was that was revealed.
The best way to understand PRISM, because there's been a little bit of controversy, is to first talk about what PRISM is. Much of the debate in the US has been about metadata. They've said it's just metadata, it's just metadata, and they're talking about a specific legal authority called Section 215 of the Patriot Act. That allows sort of warrantless wiretapping, mass surveillance of the entire country's sort of phone records, things like that, who you're talking to, when you're talking to them, where you travel. These are all metadata events. PRISM is about content. It's a program through which the government could compel corporate America. It could sort of deputize corporate America to do its dirty work for the NSA. And even though some of these companies did resist, even though some of them, I believe Yahoo was one of them, challenged them in court, they all lost because it was never tried by an open court. They were only tried by a secret court. And something that we've seen, something about the PRISM program that's very concerning to me, is there's been a talking point in the U.S. government where they've said 15 federal judges have reviewed these programs and found them to be lawful. But what they don't tell you is those are secret judges in a secret court based on secret interpretations of law that's considered 34,000 warrant requests over 33 years, and in 33 years only rejected 11 government requests. These aren't the people that we want deciding what the role of corporate America in a free and open internet should be.
Now, this slide that we're showing here shows the dates in which different technology companies, internet companies, are alleged to have joined the program and where data collection began from them. Now, they have denied collaborating with the NSA. How was that data collected by the NSA?
Right. So the NSA's own slides refer to it as direct access. What that means to an actual NSA analyst, someone like me who is working as an intelligence analyst, targeting, you know, Chinese cyber actors, things like that in Hawaii, is the provenance of that data is directly from their servers. It doesn't mean that there's a, you know, group of company representatives sitting in a smoky room with the NSA, palling around and making backroom deals about how they're going to give this stuff away. Now, each company handles it different ways. Some are responsible, some are somewhat less responsible. But the bottom line is, when we talk about how this information is given, it's coming from the companies themselves. It's not stolen from the lines. But there's an important thing to remember here. Even though companies pushed back, even though companies demanded, hey, let's do this through a warrant process. Let's do this, you know, where we actually have some sort of legal review, some sort of basis for handing over these users' data. We saw stories in the Washington Post last year that weren't as well reported as the PRISM story that said the NSA broke in to the data center communications between Google to itself and Yahoo to itself. So even these companies that are cooperating in at least a compelled but hopefully lawful manner with the NSA, the NSA isn't satisfied with that. And because of that, we need our companies to work very hard to guarantee that they're going to represent the interests of the user and also advocate for the rights of the users. And I think over the last year, we've seen the companies that are named on the PRISM slides take great strides to do that, and I encourage them to continue.
What more should they do?
The biggest thing that an internet company in America can do today, right now, without consulting with lawyers, to protect the rights of users worldwide, is to enable SSL or TLS sort of encryption, web encryption, on every page that you visit. The reason this matters is today, if you go to look at a copy of 1984 on Amazon.com, the NSA can see a record of that. The Russian intelligence service can see a record of that. The Chinese service can see a record of that. The French service, the German service, the services of Andorra, they can all see it because it's unencrypted. The world's library, Amazon.com. But not only do they not support encryption by default, you cannot choose to use encryption when browsing through books. This is something that we need to change, not just for Amazon. I don't mean to single them out, but they're a great example. All companies need to move to an encrypted browsing habit by default for all users who haven't taken any action or picked any special methods on their own. That'll increase the privacy and the rights that people enjoy worldwide.
Ed, come with me to this part of the stage. I want to show you the next slide here. This is a program called Boundless Informant. What is that?
So I've got to give credit to the NSA for using appropriate names on this. This is one of my favorite NSA cryptonyms. Boundless Informant is a program that the NSA hid from Congress. The NSA was previously asked by Congress, was there any ability that they had to even give a rough ballpark estimate of the amount of American communications that were being intercepted? They said no. They said, we don't track those stats, and we can't track those stats. We can't tell you how many communications we're intercepting around the world, because to tell you that would be to invade your privacy. Now, I really appreciate that sentiment from them, but the reality when you look at this slide is not only do they have the capability already exists. It's already in place. The NSA has its own internal data format that tracks the both ends of a communication. And if it says this communication came from America, they can tell Congress how many of those communications they have today, right now. And what Boundless Informant tells us is more communications are being intercepted in America about Americans than there are in Russia about Russians. I'm not sure that's what an intelligence agency should be aiming for.
Ed, there was a story broken in the Washington Post, again from your data. The headline says, NSA broke privacy rules thousands of times per year. Tell us about that.
We also heard in congressional testimony last year, it was an amazing thing for someone like me who came from the NSA and who's seen the actual internal documents, knows what's in them, to see officials testifying under oath that there have been no abuses, that there have been no violations of the NSA's rules. But what's especially interesting about this, about the fact that the NSA has violated their own rules, their own laws, thousands of times in a single year, including one event by itself, one event out of those 2,776, that affected more than 3,000 people. In another event, they intercepted all the calls in Washington, D.C. by accident. What's amazing about this report that didn't get that much attention, is the fact that not only were there 2,776 abuses, the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Dianne Feinstein, had not seen this report until the Washington Post contacted her asking for comment on the report. And she then requested a copy from the NSA and received it, but had never seen this before that. What does that say about the state of oversight in American intelligence when the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee has no idea that the rules are being broken thousands of times every year?
Ed, one response to this whole debate is this. It's why should we care about all this surveillance, honestly? I mean, look, if you've done nothing wrong, you've got nothing to worry about. What's wrong with that point of view?
Well, so the first thing is you're giving up your rights. You're saying, hey, you know, I don't think I'm going to need them. So I'm just going to trust that, you know, let's get rid of them. It doesn't really matter that, you know, these guys are going to do the right thing. Your rights matter because you never know when you're going to need them. Beyond that, it's a part of our cultural identity, not just in America, but in Western societies and in democratic societies around the world. People should be able to pick up the phone and to call their family. People should be able to send a text message to their loved ones. People should be able to buy a book online. They should be able to travel by train. They should be able to buy an airline ticket without wondering about how these events are going to look to an agent of the government, possibly not even your government, years in the future, how they're going to be misinterpreted and what they're going to think your intentions are. We have a right to privacy. We require warrants to be based on probable cause or some kind of individualized suspicion, because we recognize that trusting anybody, any government authority with the entirety of human communications in secret and without oversight is simply too great a temptation to be ignored.
Some people are furious at what you've done. I heard a quote recently from Dick Cheney, who said that Julian Assange was a flea bite. Edward Snowden is the lion that bit the head off the dog. He thinks you've committed one of the worst acts of betrayal in American history. What would you say to people who think that?
Dick Cheney is really something else. Thank you. I think it's amazing because at the time, Julian Assange was doing some of his greatest work. Dick Cheney was saying he was going to end governments worldwide. The skies were going to ignite and the seas were going to boil off. And now he's saying it's a flea bite. So we should be suspicious about the same sort of overblown claims of damage to national security from these kind of officials. But let's assume that these people really believe this. I would argue that they have kind of a narrow conception of national security. The prerogatives of people like Dick Cheney do not keep the nation safe. The public interest is not always the same as the national interest. Going to war with people who are not our enemy, in places that are not a threat, doesn't make us safe. And that applies whether it's in Iraq or on the internet. The internet is not the enemy. Our economy is not the enemy. American businesses, Chinese businesses, and any other company out there is a part of our society. It's a part of our interconnected world. There are ties of unity that bond us together. And if we destroy these bonds by undermining the standards, the security, the manner of behavior that nations and citizens all around the world expect us to abide by.
But, you know, it's alleged that you've stolen 1.7 million documents. It seems only a few hundred of them have been shared with journalists so far. Are there more revelations to come?
There are absolutely more revelations to come. I don't think there's any question that some of the most important reporting to be done is yet to come.
Well, let me come here, because I want to ask you about this particular revelation. Come and take a look at this. I mean, this is a story which I think for a lot of the techies in this room is the single most shocking thing that they have heard in the last few months. It's about a program called Bull Run. Could you explain what that is?
So Bull Run, and this is again where we've got to thank the NSA for their candor. This is a program named after a Civil War battle. The British counterpart is called Edgehill, which is a UK Civil War battle. And the reason that I believe they're named this way is because they target our own infrastructure. They're programs through which the NSA intentionally misleads corporate partners. They tell corporate partners that these are safe standards. They say, hey, we need to work with you to secure your systems. But in reality, they're giving bad advice to these companies that makes them degrade the security of their services. They're building in back doors that not only the NSA can exploit, but anyone else who has time and money to research and find it can then use to let themselves into the world's communications. And this is really dangerous because if we lose a single standard, if we lose the trust of something like SSL, which was specifically targeted by the Bull Run program, we will live in a less safe world overall. We won't be able to access our banks, and we won't be able to access commerce without worrying about people monitoring those communications and subverting them for their own.
And do those same decisions also potentially open America up to cyber attack from other sources?
Absolutely. One of the problems, one of sort of the dangerous legacies that we've seen in the post 9/11 era is that the NSA has traditionally worn two hats. They've been in charge of offensive operations, that is hacking, but they've also been in charge of defensive operations. And traditionally, they've always prioritized defense over offense based on the principle that American secrets are simply worth more. If we hack a Chinese business and steal their secrets, if we hack a government office in Berlin and steal their secrets, that has less value to the American people than making sure that the Chinese can't get access to our secrets. So by reducing the security of our communications, they're not only putting the world at risk, they're putting America at risk in a fundamental way, because intellectual property is the basis, the foundation of our economy. And if we put that at risk through weak security, we're going to be paying for it for years.
But they've made a calculation that it was worth doing this as part of America's defense against terrorism. Surely that makes it a price worth paying.
Well, when you look at the results of these programs stopping terrorism, you'll see that that's unfounded. And you don't have to take my word for it, because we've had the first open court, the first federal court that's reviewed this outside of sort of the secrecy arrangement, called these programs Orwellian and likely unconstitutional. The Congress, who has access to be briefed on these things and now has the desire to be, has produced bills to reform it. And two independent White House panels who reviewed all of the classified evidence said these programs have never stopped a single terrorist attack that was imminent in the United States. So is it really terrorism that we're stopping? Do these programs have any value at all? I say no, and all three branches of the American government say no as well.
I mean, do you think there's a deeper motivation for them than the war against terrorism?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you. Say again.
Sorry. Do you think there's a deeper motivation for them other than the war against terrorism?
Yeah. The bottom line is that terrorism has always been what we in the intelligence world would call a cover for action. Terrorism is something that provokes an emotional response that allows people to rationalize authorizing powers and programs that they wouldn't give otherwise. The Bull Run and Edge Hill type programs, the NSA asked for these authorities back in the 1990s. They asked the FBI to go to Congress and make the case. The FBI went to Congress and did make the case. But Congress and the American people said no. They said it's not worth the risk to our economy. They said it's worth too much damage to our society to justify the gains. But what we saw is in the post 9/11 era, they used secrecy and they used the justification of terrorism to start these programs in secret without asking Congress, without asking the American people. And it's that kind of government behind closed doors that we need to guard ourselves against, because it makes us less safe and it offers no value.
Okay, come with me here for a sec, because I've got a more personal question for you. Speaking of terror, most people would find the situation you're in right now in Russia pretty terrifying. You obviously, you know, you heard what happened, what the treatment that Bradley Manning got, Chelsea Manning as now is. And there was a story in BuzzFeed saying that there are people in the intelligence community who want you dead. How are you coping with this? How are you coping with the fear?
You know, it's no mystery that there are governments out there that want to see me dead. I've made clear again and again and again that I go to sleep every morning thinking about what I can do for the American people. I don't want to harm my government. I want to help my government. The fact that they are willing to completely ignore due process, they're willing to declare guilt without ever seeing a trial, these are things that we need to work against as a society and say, hey, this is not appropriate. We shouldn't be threatening dissidents. We shouldn't be criminalizing journalists. And whatever part I can do to see that end, I'm happy to do despite the risks.
So I'd actually like to get some feedback from the audience here, because I know there's widely differing reactions to Edward Snowden. Suppose you had the following two choices, right? You could view what he did as fundamentally a reckless act that has endangered America. Or you viewed it as fundamentally a heroic act that will work towards America and the world's long-term good. Those are the two choices I'll give you. I'm curious to see who's willing to vote with the first of those, that this was a reckless act. There are some hands going up. It's hard to put your hand up when the man is standing right here, but I see them.
I can see you.
who goes with the second choice, the fundamentally heroic act? And I think it's true to say that there are a lot of people who didn't show a hand, and I think are still thinking this through. Because it seems to me that the debate around you doesn't split along traditional political lines. It's not left or right. It's not really about pro-government, libertarian, or not just that. Part of it is almost a generational issue. You're part of a generation that grew up with the internet, and it seems as if you become offended at almost a visceral level when you see something done that you think will harm the internet. I mean, is there some truth to that?
I think it's very true. This is not a left or right issue. You know, our basic freedoms, and when I say our, I don't just mean Americans, I mean people around the world. It's not a partisan issue. These are things that all people believe in, and it's up to all of us to protect them. And to people who have seen and enjoyed a free and open internet, it's up to us to preserve that liberty for the next generation to enjoy. And if we don't change things, if we don't stand up to make the changes we need to do to keep the internet safe, not just for us, but for everyone, we're going to lose that. And that would be a tremendous loss, not just for us, but for the world.
Well, I have heard similar language recently from the founder of the World Wide Web, who I actually think is with us, Sir Tim Berners-Lee. Tim, would you like to come up and say, do we have a microphone for Tim? Tim, good to see you. Come up there. Which camp are you in, by the way? Traitor, hero. I have a theory on this. But.
I've given much longer answers to that question, but hero, if I have to make the choice between the two.
And Ed, you've read the proposal that Sir Tim's talked about a new Magna Carta to take back the internet. Is that something that makes sense?
Absolutely. I mean, my generation, I grew up not just thinking about the internet, but I grew up in the internet. And although I never expected to have the chance to defend it in such a direct and practical manner, and to sort of embody it in this unusual, almost avatar manner, I think there's something poetic about the fact that one of the sons of the internet has actually become close to the internet as a result of their political expression. And I believe that a Magna Carta for the internet is exactly what we need. We need to encode our values, not just in writing, but in the structure of the internet. And it's something that I hope, I invite everyone in the audience, not just here in Vancouver, but around the world, to join and participate in.
Do you have a question for Ed?
Well, it's the two questions, a general question.
Ed, can you still hear us?
Ed. Yes, I can hear
you.
Okay.
Oh, he's back.
Somebody, the wiretap on your line got interfered with it for a moment.
It's a little bit of an NSA problem.
So from the 25 years of sort of stepping back and thinking, what would you think would be the best that we could achieve from all the discussions that we have about the web we want?
You know, when we think about in terms of how far we can go, I think that's a question that's really only limited by what we're willing to put into it. I think the internet that we've enjoyed in the past has been exactly what we as a not just a nation, but as a people around the world need. And by cooperating, by engaging not just the technical parts of society, but as you said, the users, the people around the world who contribute through the internet, through social media, who just check the weather, who rely on it every day as a part of their life, to champion that, we'll get not just the internet we've had, but a better internet, a better now, something that we can use to build a future that'll be better not just than what we hoped for, but anything that we could have imagined.
It's 30 years ago that TED was founded, 1984. A lot of the conversation since then has been along the lines that actually George Orwell got it wrong. It's not Big Brother watching us. We, through the power of the web and transparency, are now watching Big Brother. Your revelations kind of drove a stake through the heart of that rather optimistic view. But you still believe there's a way of doing something about that.
Right. So there is an argument to be made that the powers of Big Brother have increased enormously. There was a recent legal article at Yale that established something called the Bankston-Soltani principle, which is that our expectation of privacy is violated when the capabilities of government surveillance have become cheaper by an order of magnitude. And each time that occurs, we need to revisit and rebalance our privacy problem. Now, that hasn't happened since the government's surveillance powers have increased by several magnitude, and that's why we're in the problem that we're in today. But there is still hope, because the power of individuals have also been increased by technology. I am living proof that an individual can go head-to-head against the most powerful adversaries and the most powerful intelligence agencies around the world and win. And I think that's something that we need to take hope from, and we need to build on to make it accessible not just to technical experts, but to ordinary citizens around the world. Journalism is not a crime. Communication is not a crime. And we should not be monitored in our everyday activities.
I'm not quite sure how you shake the hand of a bot, but I imagine it's...
That'll come very soon.
This is the hand right here.
Nice to meet you, and I hope my beam looks as nice as my view of you guys does.
Thank you. Right. Thank you, Tim. I mean, the New York Times recently called for an amnesty for you. Would you welcome the chance to come back to America?
Absolutely. I mean, there's really no question. The principles that have been the foundation of this project have been the public interest and the principles that underlie the journalistic establishment in the United States and around the world. And I think if the press is now saying, we support this, this is something that needed to happen, that's a powerful argument, but it's not the final argument. And I think that's something that the public should decide. But at the same time, the government has hinted that they want some kind of deal, that they want me to sort of compromise the journalists with which I've been working to come back. And I want to make it very clear that I did not do this to be safe. I did this to do what was right. And I'm not going to stop my work in the public interest just to benefit myself.
Well, in the meantime, courtesy of the internet and this technology, you're here back in North America, not quite the US, Canada, in this form. How does that feel?
Canada is different than what I expected. It's a lot warmer.
The mission is ideas worth spreading. If you could encapsulate it in a single idea, what is your idea worth spreading right now at this moment?
I would say the last year has been a reminder that democracy may die behind closed doors, but we as individuals are born behind those same closed doors. And we don't have to give up our privacy to have good government. We don't have to give up our liberty to have security. And I think by working together, we can have both open government and private lives. And I look forward to working with everyone around the world to seeing that happen. Thank you very much.
Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
A new investigation by The Intercept reveals the National Security Agency and its British counterpart, the GCHQ, hacked into the internal computer network of the largest manufacturer of SIM cards in the world, stealing encryption keys used to protect the privacy of cell phone communications across the globe. The secret operation targeted the Dutch company Gemalto. Its clients include AT&T, T-Mobile, Verizon, Sprint, and some 450 wireless network providers around the world. It produces 2 billion SIM cards a year. According to The Intercept, the stolen encryption keys give intelligence agencies the ability to monitor mobile communications without seeking or receiving approval from telecom companies and foreign governments.
Agents from the NSA and the GCHQ formed the Mobile Handset Exploitation Team in 2010 to specifically target vulnerabilities in cell phones. The intelligence agencies obtained the encryption keys by hacking into the email and Facebook accounts of engineers and other employees of Gemalto and other major companies. Some of the employees were singled out for sending PGP encrypted files. The Intercept's report was written by Jeremy Scahill and Josh Begley. It was based on documents leaked by NSA whistleblower Ed Snowden. To talk more about the significance of the story, we're joined by Chris Segoyan. He is the principal technologist at the American Civil Liberties Union, also a visiting fellow at Yale Law School's Information Society Project. The Great SIM Heist, How Spies Stole the Keys to the Encryption Castle, is the name of the story. Chris, welcome to Democracy Now!, joining us from Charlottesville, Virginia today. Talk about the significance. What is the Great SIM Heist?
Well, what we've learned is that GCHQ has been engaged in an extremely aggressive effort to obtain these encryption keys. In essence, over the last probably 5 years or so, telecom companies, wireless carriers around the world have upgraded their networks and moved from older, less secure second generation phone technology to more secure 3G and 4G technology. And as the networks have moved to this newer technology, it's become much more difficult for governments to spy on communications that take place outside of their own countries. So for GCHQ, for NSA, for the Chinese and for the Russian governments to be able to spy on telephone calls everywhere in the world, they need these kinds of keys. What we've learned just yesterday is that by hacking into one of the largest manufacturers of SIM card keys or of SIM cards and the keys that are on them, GCHQ has really acquired a huge amount of information that will make bulk surveillance of telephone communications very, very easy.
Technically work? Would they be sweeping up in real time all of the conversations and then storing them someplace to be able to look back at them further? Or, I mean, how exactly would it work?
Right. So there's a special NSA outfit, an NSA CIA outfit called the Special Collection Service, SCS. And so they're based out of embassies and consulates around the world. And they install these antennas on the roofs of embassies and other buildings. And with those antennas, they're able to grab the data from phones as it's sent over the air. And so what they'll do is they'll set up these what are called spy nests and grab as many telephone communications as they possibly can and save them. But these telephone communications, telephone calls, text messages, and other information are encrypted. And so they save the information, and then once they have the keys, either because they hack into a company like Gemalto, or they bribe an engineer or blackmail an engineer, then they can decrypt the communications. And so essentially wiretapping then just becomes a mere task of installing an antenna somewhere and recording data.
You compare the use of encryption keys on SIM cards to the way social security numbers are used today. Can you explain?
Sure. So social security numbers were designed in the 1930s for a pretty mundane and basic task, which was keeping track of one's contributions to their retirement account, their government retirement account. But today they're used as a quasi-national identification number. We're supposed to give our social security numbers to, you know, a huge number of organizations. It's how we're tracked. And the reason we sort of have this system is because there was no formal national identity number. Everyone wants to have one, and so the social security number has sort of been forced into that role, but it's a role that it was never designed or intended for. By the same token, SIM cards were never really intended to provide strong confidentiality of communications. They weren't intended to provide strong encryption or strong protection of our communications. Instead, they were really intended to protect telephone numbers and telephone accounts from fraud. In the 80s and 1990s, there was a huge wave of fraud where people were doing what's called cell phone cloning, and they were billing calls to other people's accounts. And this was a huge problem for the phone companies. They needed a solution, and SIM cards and the encryption keys within them were the solution that they came up with. You know, we should understand that SIM cards probably cost, 50 cents or a dollar in bulk. These are not, you know, extremely sophisticated, high-security devices. They are basic bits of technology that are designed for one job, which is fraud, that we now depend on for so much more. And if this story demonstrates one thing, and one thing alone, it's that SIM cards and the system of security that surrounds them just isn't up to the job of protecting our communications.
But I want to go back to something you said before about U.S. embassies being used basically as the centers for grabbing this data in these different countries. In effect, what you're saying is that virtually every U.S. embassy is basically a spying operation, possibly breaking laws in the very countries that they are that they're located in.
My understanding is that's the norm for embassies around the world, not just the U.S. You know, intelligence agencies operate out of embassies, sometimes with cover. Last summer, Der Spiegel published a slide listing the locations of NSA, CIA, Special Collection Service sites around the world. This is something that's been written about in books before. It's not a big secret. And after the Angela Merkel spying story first broke, one of the German newspapers even published thermal imaging photographs of the spy nest on the roof of the U.S. embassy in Berlin before the story and after the story, showing that the station had been shut down and was thus generating much less heat and using much less electricity.
Chris, when asked for comment by Reuters, GCHQ said its work, quote, is carried out in accordance with a strict legal and policy framework, which ensures our activities are authorized, necessary, and proportionate, they said. Can you respond to that? And we just have less than a minute. How the GCHQ and NSA hacked into the emails and Facebook accounts of employees of telecom companies?
Right. So GCHQ and NSA believe that essentially anything is justified as long as it gets them to where they want to be. The engineers at Gemalto, you know, were not accused of breaking the law. Gemalto itself is not a criminal enterprise, but these governments want the keys that Gemalto has, and so they're willing to do, you know, anything it takes to get that. You know, in the last few moments that I have, I really want to let your listeners know that there are things that you can do right now to protect your communications, that the telephone companies have not shown any interest in providing us with secure communications. You cannot trust the voice or text message services provided by your wireless carrier, so you need to download apps. There are some built into the iPhone, iMessage, and FaceTime. There are tools like WhatsApp that's distributed by Facebook, and there are some even better tools like Signal, which is supported by the U.S. government, actually. You can download apps and services and make encrypted telephone calls, send encrypted text messages that governments cannot easily intercept, but those tools will not be provided to you by your telephone company. You need to take steps and take matters into your own hand.
Chris Segoyan, in part two of our discussion, first quickly summarize what the Great SIM Heist is.
So in this operation, GCHQ, which is Britain's intelligence agency, hacked into this major Dutch supplier of SIM cards. This is a company that provides these microchips to wireless carriers around the world. And these are the chips that provide the security that's in our phones. They secure the communications between our phone and the phone network and are intended to protect our calls and text messages from interception by private parties.
Should Gemalto be doing? Can they protect the SIM card?
I mean, what's in the story, the anecdotes that are revealed in the story suggest that Gemalto and its wireless carrier partners have at times followed pretty pathetic security practices. And so it didn't seem like that GCHQ had to work too hard in some cases. But, you know, that was just for some of the collection. In other cases, it seems like GCHQ's hackers targeted and hunted individual engineers and employees. I mean, they were stalking these engineers online in an effort to compromise their email accounts, their Facebook accounts, and then ultimately to compromise their computers as a way to gain access to the inner sanctum of Gemalto's network. That kind of stalking of engineers is really terrifying. Particularly given that, you know, we're not talking here about, you know, a government stalking or targeting a terrorist. These engineers are not accused of breaking any law. These are law-abiding people who have mortgages and families and husbands and wives, and they just happen to work for companies that these intelligence agencies, you know, think are fair game. And, you know, I think this article building on the Intercept's piece last year about GCHQ's hacking of Belgacom, Belgium's largest phone company, is really going to serve as a wake-up call to the entire technical industry because, you know, in essence now, it seems clear that any engineer at any company that does anything remotely interesting is now fair game for GCHQ and NSA and their other partners.
How do AT&T and Verizon compare to companies like Google and Apple?
So the phone companies don't do a very good job in securing their communications. The encryption technology that's built into your phone, the technology that protects your telephone calls and text messages as they go over the air, the encryption was built in the late 80s and early 90s. Forms of it were broken in the 1990s by graduate students, and we're still using it today. These carriers are these large multi-billion-dollar telephone companies are really not that interested in providing a secure method of communication. They're certainly not interested in designing or deploying methods of communication that our own governments cannot intercept, let alone other governments. And you know, for more than 100 years, the U.S. telephone companies have been happily providing wiretapping assistance to law enforcement and intelligence agencies. We should give up on this idea that AT&T or T-Mobile or Verizon are ever going to deliver truly secure communications to their customers. You know, in contrast, you know, it really does seem like Silicon Valley companies are much more interested in providing strong, secure communication services to the extent that their business models permit. And what I mean by that is, you know, at the end of the day, you're not paying Google for their services, and so they want to read your emails. But a company like Apple, who, you know, Apple doesn't make money by selling you email service. They make money by selling you an expensive phone. And as long as you keep buying the phones, Apple makes lots of money. For companies like that, where their business model and your privacy are more aligned, I really do think we can expect that these companies will provide us with much stronger and much more secure methods of communication, particularly given that they're competing in a global market where, you know, German consumers don't want a phone that can be easily spied on by the NSA. And so, you know, these tech companies really are having to up their game.
So, Chris Segoyan, you started in part one of our interview talking about how people can protect themselves. Mm-hmm. Explain further what people can do.
Sure. So again, the voice and text message services provided by your wireless carrier, if you're just sending a text message through your phone or making a telephone call through your phone, those calls can be intercepted by your own government, by police and intelligence agencies. They can be intercepted by foreign governments who are operating domestically. They can be intercepted by sophisticated criminals and by hackers and by stalkers. You should not expect that those kinds of communication services can deliver real security. On the other hand, there are now a number of apps and internet-based services that you can run on your smartphone that will give you much, much more secure communications. So Apple has built iMessage into its iPhone product for several years. If you have an iPhone and you're sending a text message to someone else who has an iPhone, this is used by default. Those messages are encrypted in a strong way. They're sent via Apple system, and it's very, very difficult for governments to intercept those. If you're using WhatsApp, which is a service now owned by Facebook and used by hundreds of millions of people around the world, if you're using WhatsApp on Android, it's encrypted, again, in a very strong way. And if you have an Android or iPhone, you can download third-party apps that the best of which are called Signal for iOS and Text Secure, T-E-X-T, Secure, from Android. These are best of breed free applications made by top security researchers and actually subsidized by the State Department and by the US taxpayer. You can download these tools today. You can make encrypted telephone calls. You can send encrypted text messages. You can really up your game and protect your communications. To be clear, if you are a target of a law enforcement or intelligence agency and they really care about you, they can hack into your phone. And these tools won't stop that, but you can make it much more difficult. You can make it so that they have to work really hard. And, you know, it's unfortunate that the phone companies, that AT&T and Verizon, haven't warned their customers. They should be telling the public. They haven't. But we can do things right now to make wiretapping much more difficult and much more expensive.
Is it possible to use a phone without a SIM card?
No, the SIM card is sort of like the driver's license for the phone. The SIM card proves that you have a valid account. That's, you know, what lets the phone company know who to send the bill to. So you need a SIM card. You know, think of it this way. When you go to Starbucks, you don't expect Starbucks to provide you with a secure internet connection. You expect them to provide you with an internet connection, and then you bring your own security on top. If you're using Gmail or Facebook or Twitter, all of those services build their own security in. They don't rely on the internet provider to do that for you. By the same token, we should stop relying on the AT&Ts and Verizons of the world to provide security. We should just use them for data. And then we should run secure encrypted communications apps that go over the data portion of the network. We know how to do this. These apps exist. We can secure our communications. And, you know, it's been delightful post Snowden. You know, the journalism community is really starting to take note of this. And I now regularly have encrypted telephone calls with national security reporters around the world. I send encrypted emails with reporters, with lawyers. These tools really are getting to be easy to use. And it's just, we just need more people to start using them.
So explain again, if you just want to make a phone call, but you don't want it to be listened to or tracked, how would you do that? How would you encrypt a phone call?
So if you have an Apple device, you could download, so FaceTime is already installed in your iPhone. It's built by Apple, it's built to the iPhone. If you make a FaceTime audio or video call from your iPhone to someone else's iPhone or iPad, it's encrypted with very strong technology, and it would be very, very difficult for a government to intercept. If you don't want to use an Apple encryption product, there's a fantastic app in the App Store called Signal, S-I-G-N-A-L. It's free, it's open source, it's very, very good. That makes encrypted telephone calls anywhere in the world for free. Even if you're not worried about security, it's actually a way of saving money on your phone bill. And then if you're using Android, there's a great app by the same people who do Signal called Redphone, R-E-D-P-H-O-N-E. Again, it's free. It's supported by the U.S. government. So you're paying for it anyway. You might as well use it. And that will also let you make free encrypted telephone calls. These tools work, and they make wiretapping much more expensive, which is what we want. We want governments to have to focus their resources on the people that really matter, the real threats. But they shouldn't be able to spy on everyone at low cost.
I also wanted to ask about another NSA story in the news this week. This new probe that finds the NSA has embedded spying devices deep inside hard drives and computers around the world. The Russian firm Kaspersky Lab says it uncovered the spyware in personal computers across 30 countries from Iran to Russia, Pakistan, Libya, China, Belgium, Ecuador, and the United States. The targets include government institutions, oil and gas firms, Islamic activists, scholars, and the media. Can you comment on this, Chris Goyen?
Sure. So the NSA has a multi-billion-dollar budget. They hire some of the best and brightest hackers, and they give these really smart people a lot of resources and basically tell them that they can do whatever they want. And, you know, it's not surprising that a well-resourced team that is not constrained by the law can get up to a lot of really interesting and terrifying things. You know, they've been given a mandate by their superiors to go out and hack and get access to every system they can, and they're doing that. You know, in one way, as someone with a technical background, I'm impressed with what they've been able to do. But I think, you know, we should all be very scared about what the NSA is doing, the capabilities they have, and the extreme lack of effective oversight that's taking place. For an agency that is engaged in this degree of highly sophisticated technical compromise of computer systems, the extent to which policymakers and agency overseers lack technical competence, I think, should be terrifying. We need to make sure that those in Congress, those in the courts who are supposed to perform oversight over the NSA, we need to make sure that they have technical understanding or technical advisors. And the fact that there's no technical oversight of these agencies, I think, is one of the reasons why they've been able to do as much as they have with as little oversight.
Chris, why is the government funding the apps that you're recommending that make it harder to break into, eavesdrop on texts or calls?
Because they're tools of foreign policy. It's the U.S. government isn't this one machine with one person, you know, dictating all of its policies. You have these different agencies squabbling, sometimes doing contradictory things. The U.S. government, the State Department, has spent millions of dollars over the last 10 years to fund the creation and the deployment and improvement to secure communications and secure computing tools that were intended to allow activists in China and Iran to communicate, that are intended to allow journalists to do their thing and spread news about democracy without fear of interception and surveillance by the Chinese and other governments.
But maybe the U.S. government has a way to break in.
Well, you know, it's possible that they've discovered flaws, but, you know, the U.S. government hasn't been writing the software. They've been giving grants to highly respected research teams, security researchers and academics. And these tools are about the best that we have. You know, I agree. I think it's a little bit odd that, the State Department's funding this, but these tools aren't getting a lot of funding from other places. And so as long as the State Department's willing to write them checks, I'm happy that the Tor Project and Whisper Systems and these other organizations are cashing them. They are creating great tools and great technology that can really improve our security, and I hope that they'll get more money in the future.
And Chris, very quickly, what's the legislation you think needs to be passed, at least in the United States, to protect privacy?
I mean, we need so much. We need a technically informed FISA court, we need controls over domestic surveillance, but we also need strict oversight and legislative controls over what NSA does abroad, which right now are largely regulated under Executive Order 12333. Most of the scary things that NSA does, it doesn't have to go to the FISA court to get approval for, and I think we really need to rein that in.
Chris Segoyan, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Privacy researcher and activist, principal technologist at the American Civil Liberties Union, also a visiting fellow at Yale Law School's Information Society Project. You can also go back to democracynow.org to see part one of this conversation. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
And you can indeed hear the rest of that conversation at democracynow.org, just as you can hear this entire